I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trust, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
We thought we'd have a special third co-host this week. So we do. Matt Sheeran is with us. Welcome, Matt.
Hi guys, how are you doing?
Do you go by Matt or Matthew?
Either. Should we say Matt?
I'm just curious, you know, if it...
Yeah, people just decide. I don't really mind.
We're going to have Matthew Sheeran here with us today. Per usual, we're going to run through the top 10 of the Hot 100 just a few seconds. Big week at number one for an artist who is, getting familiar with that spot pretty comfortably in the past couple years.
There's also a song at number two called Perfect. So that's coming up in the top 10. As always, we'll get into, new number one on the Hot 100. We'll talk about that. And really, Matt, we're just going to get into a lot of the stuff you've done and specifically working on Ed Sheeran, your brother's Perfect, recent number one hit, number one in your native UK as well. So we'll get into all that. Grammys, obviously, were last week. I figured we'd just talk about the Grammys first. I feel like I was talking to Keith Caulfield, who is our other co-director of charts. He manages the Billboard 200. He was in New York for the Grammys. We're saying that Grammys sort of every year, it's kind of one of those things where no matter who wins, no one's ever fully happy. You can't make anyone happy with the Grammy Awards.
I think Bruno Mars is probably happy, but yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like he... obviously had a fantastic night. If you somehow missed it and missed the news, Bruno Mars took the top three awards of the night, album, record, and song of the year. So a nice little sort of spread for Bruno. The album 24 Karat Magic, the song 24 Karat Magic was record of the year, but That's What I Like ended up being song of the year. So, you know, everything in the Bruno catalog got a little bit of a shine.
Yeah, so on the podcast last week, we had Paul Grine as our guest, who started the Chartbeat column in Billboard back in 1981. And that's exactly what he was saying, that Trevor and I were kind of saying how, you know, maybe this is Kendrick Lamar's year. And Paul, he's been studying patterns of the Grammys over the years, and he could see how some of the hip-hop stuff, how Kendrick and Jay-Z maybe were going to split the vote, leaving it wide open for Bruno to win, and that's what happened.
Yeah, no, it's not that surprising. It's kind of similar to other things that have won in the past, and it's the same guys voting, so kind of retrospectively it makes sense, like everything does.
Yeah, I think what was interesting is a lot of the promo leading up to the Grammys, even from the Grammys themselves, we're saying how this is a year of more diversity. We've got more hip-hop acts. We've got Despacito, a huge Latin hit. And then when Bruno Mars wins, it almost kind of feels like, oh, you know, after all that buildup of all these different potential winners, we wound up with, you know, fairly safe middle-of-the-road choice of all those songs.
Yeah, a lot of people, of course, you know, in the immediate aftermath, the Twitter trolls are out there. And I think people were a little more torn with Bruno, because a lot of people did like him and they recognized that it's not, you know, the most typical Grammy genre. So there was still some sort of stretch there. But also, you know, for Jay-Z to go 0-for-8 for the night was kind of upsetting to a lot of people. You know, he's right there in the front row with Beyonce and gets shut out. Kendrick had one award on the telecast, kind of relegated to the pre-show, even though he won, I think, 5 awards, but only one on TV. And definitely one other sort of big thing that people noticed, only one woman winning on the main telecast. That was the Best New Artist Award. Right. Went to Alessia Cara. So people noticing the gender sort of imbalance there as well.
You tell us what you want to tell us, Matt. But a lot of the talk was that the word snub was used for Ed in the main categories. And is that how you feel? Do you feel like Shape of You should have been up for Record of the Year, Song of the Year? Divide should have been up for... obviously, you might be a little biased, but what's your take?
Well, I think Shape of You certainly probably should have, based on its popularity. If Despacito is going to be nominated, I don't see where the logic is that Shape of You wasn't. I mean, if Despacito wasn't nominated, then yeah, I guess that makes sense. But yeah, I think that's what most people have been saying. But yeah, but you know, every year someone's not gonna.
Yes, it definitely seemed to be an unfortunate timing year, just because, like we were saying, I mean, there's so much, a big wave, especially last year after Beyonce did not win in the top categories, move towards embracing more hip-hop, more R&B, and it seems like that, unfortunately, you know, coincided with the time of Ed's latest album and song. But I think a lot of people, yeah, again, were really surprised that such a massive hit like Shape of You, as we mentioned last week on the podcast, a lot of big hits in the past decade have walked away with that honor. Uptown Funk, Bruno Again, Hello, Rolling in the Deep, Somebody That I Used to Know. All those, you know, major hits. So for Shape of You to be absent is going to look weird.
I feel like it probably wouldn't have won either if it had, but I think it should have been nominated at least for Song of the Year. So, but anyway, yeah. I'm biased.
And then Ed wins in the pop category against Four Women, and it's like he can't win because a lot of people are, especially with the performance of Praying by Kesha, a lot of people look at the power of that song and the vocal and the meaning of the lyrics, kind of thinking that, you know, Ed should have won the big categories. Maybe Kesha should have won in that category specifically.
Yeah, I mean, they should have separate categories for male vocals and female vocals, I think. I think that would probably be a good way around this. They should do it at the Oscars as well for directors. And yeah, it should be, just be a thing that we do more now, like we do in athletics.
I mean, they used to have, obviously, male, female separated for all the genres, and then there was a big overhaul that combined a lot of those together. I mean, yeah, it'd be interesting to see sort of how the results play out in the first couple of years. I know a lot of those awards have been pretty male-leaning, so it'll be interesting to see going forward, you know, how they try to rectify that. But you know, congrats to the Sheeran family. Two more Grammys in the bag this year. So, yeah.
Did you guys celebration afterwards? The whole family is in New York, right?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure we'll celebrate maybe tonight. Yeah. I haven't seen him yet, so hopefully we'll do that tonight.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the Billboard Hot 100 this week. Here is this week's top 10.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10.
I'm a fucking soldier. Ay, always lit. Yeah, I'm never sober. It's for 3 days in a row. Y'all bitch coming over. Told that bitch to kick rock. She act like it's a boulder. Ay, Rory, shopping. That mean...
Number 9.
Fuck 'em. All that peace and that unity, all that weak shit have ruined me. Fuck 'em. Yeah. Cause niggas started talking to me like I'm slowing down.
Number 6. Number 5.
Man, I feel just like a rock star. All my brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a rock star. Fucking with me, call up on the Uzi.
Number 3. And number 1.
God's plan. I hold back, sometimes I won't, yeah. I feel good, sometimes I don't, like, yeah. I finesse down Western Road, like, yes. Might go down to G-O-D, yeah.
There we go, right out of the gate, the first time you're even hearing it on this podcast, a brand new number one from the sixth god himself, God's Plan. Huge debut for Drake this week, most impressively coming right out of the gate with a record 68 million on-demand streams. So as we saw over the course of the week, you know, setting new records on U.S. Spotify, on Apple Music around the world. So obviously, as we've learned by now, if you haven't learned this by now, you really need to learn this by now. When Drake puts out a song, people are going to stream it in numbers you have not seen before.
He had the album last year, and to see this, it just reaffirms that exactly what you're saying. That he puts out a surprise release, especially, that's going to up the numbers.
Yeah, and I feel like, I mean, I guess I need to do like almost a cross-section on Drake's fan base because, you know, nobody seems to have the same kind of intersection that he can just to command all these people in the first week to go out there and listen to these songs. I mean, you thought, we saw, you know, recently Post Malone kind of blow out of the gate with huge numbers as well, and Drake just, I mean, leaps and bounds past that.
I feel like it's interesting, too, that he put out two, you know, core rap songs. It's not like one is for the rap audience, one's more for the pop audience, like a one dance. He just went straight rap on this, and maybe with hip-hop being as big as it is now, he doesn't need to put out a full-on pop song at the moment, or he just didn't want to.
I mean, the backing music to it is not, you know, it's not necessarily hardcore hip-hop, not gruff. I mean, right. there's a you know, a one dance kind of grooving, like More Life element.
Yeah,
I just feel like you could if you heard that music for like God's Plan by itself, like, yes, it lends itself to a rap song, but you could dance to it in a way that maybe you can't dance to a Bodak Yellow, to a Motorsport in the same kind of way.
Well, I quite like the background track. I've just been thinking about it, actually, the chord sequence. I like it. It's just a sort of feeling in the end, isn't it?
I like the feeling. 60 million people like the feeling. Enough people to get it to number one, where it does become the 29th song in Hot 100 history to start right at the top. For Drake's career overall, this marks his 4th number one. If you guys need a quick refresher, he was featured on 2 Rihanna number ones, his first two trips to the top, on What's My Name way back in 2010 when he was just, you know, a pretty wee lad out of the gate, and in 2016 again on Work, and then later in 2016 he got his first as a lead artist with the song One Dance alongside Wizkid and Kyla. And now here he is back on top with God's Plan.
And God's Plan, not the only new song by Drake in the top 10. We heard back at number 7, Diplomatic Immunity debuted as well.
Yeah, and so right there, 1 and 7, Drake having two songs to debut in the top 10 this week. It's actually done this before in his career. When the More Life album came out in spring of last year, the songs Passion Fruit and Portland debuted at 8 and 9 on the Hot 100. So Drake, once again, debuting two songs in the top 10 in the same week. Only one other artist in Hot 100 history has been able to cross that milestone off. Any guesses in the room about who might have been the first person?
It's a leading question.
To have two songs debut in the top 10 in the same week. You got a guess for us, Matt?
Someone you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, him. Oh, yeah. It is Ed Sheeran. Last year when Shape of You debuted at number 1, and Castle on the Hill debuted at number 6, just around this time last year. So,
right.
So a nice little anniversary present for that.
So with those two songs, so he gets his 21st and 22nd Hot 100 Top 10, and that's a new record among rappers. So Jay-Z with 21. So last week, Drake was at 20. This week, he adds 2.
Not a good week for Jay-Z.
Yeah, adding a little insult to the Grammy's injury. But Drake, the new rapper with the most top 10s all time on the Hot 100, he's more than a rapper. He's a singer, writer, producer, has a lot of different sides.
He's evolved at this
right.
point, yeah.
All right, so so nice of Ed Sheeran to make room for Drake at number one. We're going to get into Perfect, Matt, of how the song came about and your involvement in it. But the song is so ubiquitous at this point. It's just.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique and your conversations should reflect that.
eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everywhere are you? Is it still exciting when you hear Perfect?
I'm not listening to it at the moment. I'm trying to take some time out.
You know, for a song, I think for a lot of people, when we hear it, you know, in the past couple months on the radio, how long have you been sitting with this song in terms of your idea? Or like, is this something that, you know, you've been playing with for 3 years and now
April 2016, and the song was written in August 2015. So it's been around for a very long time.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it's been all...
Yeah, I know.
We're just
tell me about
up.
It. Right? Yeah, yeah.
So how did you first hear it? Did Ed just play it for you one day?
Yeah, we were in the car and he was playing me all the new songs of the album, many of which aren't on there. And yeah, no, the Perfect was the least sort of produced one. It was very sort of out of tune guitar, like a very rough recording, and all the other ones were more sort of produced and stuff. So I didn't really sort of take any notice of it, to be honest. And then
really,
then he came back later, he's like, oh, do you remember that song Perfect? And I was like, yeah, and actually I didn't remember it. yeah,
so he was all excited about it because it was different. It was the ballad.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He had a vision in his head which no one else could hear. So, yeah.
Was there a song that he did play in that drive that stood out to you?
I really like Dive. It's a shame that wasn't a single. I think that's probably my favorite on the album.
Well, it's still time, yeah.
Yeah, no, there was one called, what was it called? What Do I Know? I watched that. I watched him writing that, and that was, I really like that one. That's pretty fun. It's a cool album. Yeah.
Does he run music by you a lot? Is that a typical thing?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. There's so much that's never been released.
Are you, as brothers, are you totally honest in your?
You
criticize them maybe way
well,
more than else would, right?
Well, you've got to. Like I remember, when he first started out, there was one song he played me, and I told him I didn't like it, and he said he'd never played it again. And I was like,
oh.
Okay. I don't know if that was some lost masterpiece or something. I think you can say you don't like, or something's not your cup of tea, and that doesn't mean it's bad. And I think people need to do that more. Say, rather than I think this person's terrible, rather that's not my cup of tea, but for that genre, it's good. But I don't understand why. If that makes sense. Generally like your stuff, yeah.
There we go. So I guess growing up, how did music enter the Sheeran household? I know you're older than Ed by a couple of years, but who was the first to kind of explore music and bring it to the forefront?
Well, we listened to music in the car constantly, a lot of very long drives. It was mostly sort of 80s music, Kate Bush, there was some Elton John, Van Morrison, and I like Ed, like kind of he loved this stuff, but I kind of didn't. So I kind of, my grandparents my grandmother was an opera singer, and so I was sort of, that's sort of how I got into music, through her rather than through my parents' taste in music. So it kind of skipped a generation.
And you performed in operas and churches?
Yeah. No, I was when we moved to Suffolk when I was six, I joined the local church choir, and I did. And Ed joined as well, and that's kind of probably why we've, you know, he's got the sing. He can sing in tune and everything, and sung loads of solos. We have a composer called Benjamin Britten, who's a local composer who wrote a lot of children's operas. So I was in a few of those. So yeah, it was very fun. But then my voice broke and I stopped. So I also play the violin, so I was doing that all that time. Yeah.
So when you heard opera music and classical music, is that just sort of where your mind?
So much opera, but yeah, classical music. Opera's like the rap of classical music. You either really, really love it, or you're like, don't really like it at all. So I've struggled liking opera, to be honest. But I like the odd aria and stuff, but they're so long.
So it's more, you like more instrumental music?
Yeah, especially sort of chamber music, so not orchestral music, so like only a few instruments. It's sort of more intimate. That's the sort of stuff that I would like to write for pleasure and listen to. But yeah, orchestral stuff's fun as well.
Even though you both grew up with music, Perfect. Is that really the first time you guys collaborated on a song?
I did some strings for Dive, which didn't make the album, and that was the first time we collaborated, literally like a few weeks earlier. And it was kind of interesting because I thought this is either going to work really, really well or it's going to work really, really badly, because we have both very different tastes in music. So I'm more into sort of melody and harmony. He's very into lyrics, and I'm not very interested in lyrics, so I'll listen to a song and I love the melody and the chords and stuff, and he won't like the lyrics of it, so he won't like the song. So it's kind of that sort of vibe going on. But yeah, it worked out really well because I kind of knew the sort of stuff he liked, so that was really helpful.
So it was a good experience.
Absolutely perfect.
No clashes, yeah. No nothing.
Not at all. No, but I mean, there easily could have been, but because you never know. But there wasn't, and it was really fun. Yeah.
You said earlier that he'd played it for you before, and you kind of didn't think.
Well, I mean, there are so many songs that he plays me and they're all just with guitar because they sort of haven't been produced yet, so they all merge into one, if that makes sense. Because
I can only imagine. Yeah. But did then when it came time to rework the song, did he reach out to you and ask you to come in, or did you have suggestions?
No, he reached out to me. He wanted to do a more left field type sort of thing and have a he's known for his loop pedal and everything, and everything's very, very minimalist and sort of one man band type thing. And he wanted to do a sort of classic sound, like Frank Sinatra type sort of vibe with a full orchestra where it builds up. And that was basically the brief. And so I listened to loads of Nelson Riddle arrangements, Nat King Cole, a lot of that to kind of get sort of pumped up for it before I began work on it. So just to be clear, the original version of Perfect was the Bocelli version, but in English, and then later on that was changed slightly to the version we hear on the radio now. And there's also an acoustic version which was pitched as the main version, which has also been released, which is very worth listening to as well. So there's just so many versions, it gets so confusing.
Right. So were you in the studio when Bocelli was recording his vocals?
We recorded them twice. So, we should probably start with the orchestral. We recorded the orchestra first. Okay. Bocelli's like a year and a half later. So I wrote the song in sheet music. And then I had to create what's called a MIDI mock-up, where you use fake virtual instruments to simulate what an orchestra would sound like. You do this in film music a lot so that directors can know what they're paying for and whether to because it's so much money to pay for an orchestra. So I had to create a simulated version, which I then emailed to Ed when he was on the executive producer of the album, Benny Blanco, who you probably heard of. Scared of flying, so they got the boat from New York to London, to the UK. So Ed was on this boat for like a week, kind of claustrophobic. And whilst he was on the boat, I sent him my MIDI mock-up of the orchestral version. So and he liked it. I mean, I would have made any changes he wants, but there was only one very minor change where something had to be repeated twice. So yeah, so that's. And then we had the go ahead to record it at Abbey Road, which we then did, which was really great.
Right. Yeah. Do you feel the history or the sense of?
Oh yeah, it's fantastic. It was in Studio 2, and yeah, we had a very generous amount of time to rehearse it, and we actually filmed him singing it with the orchestra, which will be seen in an upcoming documentary. So the whole process was. Sort of documented by cameras and everything, and all his songwriting is filmed, so it's absolutely fascinating to see the sort of moment of truth when he gets those kind of amazing ideas. You guys are in for a treat when this thing comes out.
I'm excited
because it's very unusual for people to do this. You imagine if with the Beatles you could see them writing these great hits, right. And we'd see where, yeah.
And of course, were you surprised or excited at least when you heard it was going to be picked as the single, not just make the album, but you know, be the next song out there?
Well, I mean, I've been told this was going to be the taste. Anyway, apparently the song had gone down very, very well with a lot of Edward's friends and stuff. And apparently, yeah, not, so yeah, it was expected that it would do very well. But no pressure, right? Well, you know. So we recorded with the orchestra, and then they didn't think that the radio would play it, and it kind of didn't gel in with the rest of the songs on the album. So they got a guy called Will Hicks to produce it, and there's a new beginning and new drums and everything, and that's the version that we hear on the radio. And then Ed was like, "Oh, we need to do something with this orchestral version," and he wanted to release it at Christmas because it's got a kind of Christmassy feeling,
right.
And he was like, "Oh, we should get Andrea Bocelli to sing it in Italian." Like, so I was like, "Okay, some crazy idea." And Ed's crazy ideas always work. Like, he really knows what he's doing. So we had to get it translated into Italian. So the very next day after he told me this, I went to this wedding. There happened to be an Italian translator there, and I was like, "Do you want to translate this song into Italian?" And so we got starting on that because it needed to be incredibly accurate. The melody couldn't change. And Italian's a very different language to English because it's syllabic. There's very few monosyllabic words in Italian. So that makes it very difficult to translate it into properly. And And also, this wasn't the first time that I'd been involved translating one of Ed's songs. I got his Hobbit song, I See Fire, translated into the language of the dwarves as like a Christmas present, because it's difficult to get people like Ed Christmas presents because, you know, they've already got everything. So that was quite a cool thing to do. Heard it, darling, you look perfect tonight.
Sei la mia donna, la forza delle onde del mare, cogli i miei sogni, i miei segreti, molto di più. Spero che un giorno...
So we recorded at Andrea's house in Italy.
Yeah.
So I went over first, but we still hadn't sort of finalized the Italian words because he's very particular about the type of vowel sounds, etc., that he's, you know, we needed to get it as good as possible. So we went over and we sort of finalized that, and he also really wanted to get to know the song in his sort of throat to really kind of do a really good job. And then he was going to do it again, and we're probably going to get Ed on but yeah, we're going to get Ed on Skype to kind of supervise that. And then Ed broke his arms, and he had to cancel a couple of concerts, and so he was able to go over to Italy himself and record the duet with Andrea. And so that would never have happened if that video would not exist, because there was no time to do this. This was about October, November of last right. year. And and that's the end of that story. And obviously there's the Beyonce version was released just beforehand, and yeah, this sort of contributed to the song being Christmas number one, because there's different audiences, you know, Beyonce fans that are not necessarily fans of Ed's other stuff. They wanted to hear that version of the song. And, you know, Bocelli fans that they may not even have heard of Ed, and they wanted to hear whatever Bocelli does. So, it was successful.
It'd be, you know, no matter which version it is, that there's such an orchestral feel overall to the song. To hear that, like, every time I still hear it on the radio, that is right after the first chorus where it goes into the strings, it just always hits me out. It's kind of cool to hear that nowadays in a pop song on the radio.
Because I was looking at all these great arrangers from the past and stuff, and there's certain ground rules that you've got to sort of follow, because let's say Ed singing, you don't want the orchestra to do something really complicating and distracting. So it's like, na, 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 do, 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 do. So you have it in between the lines, you have the different orchestral interjections in between his lines. Yeah, of course, this is in Italian now, but I'm sort of familiar with it all being English. But yeah. Also, in the interestingly, in the Perfect Symphony version, you've got the piccolo solo in the first verse. It's not a flute, it's a piccolo playing in its low register, and that kind of symbolizes the woman of the song. So, I found a girl, and then you have the piccolo coming in, and that's sort of, and then the piccolo comes back at the end. And yeah, sort of.
So that's the mind of the arranger.
Yeah, yeah. And it was actually quite a difficult song to arrange because in the original demo that Ed sent me, he did some of the harmonies and chords with his voice, and it sounds fantastic. But when you transcribe that onto instruments, for some reason, it didn't work with instruments, even though it worked with his voice. It's really, really curious. I have no idea why either. It's just one of those things. And so it sounds very simple, some of the music, like in the first chorus, the strings and that sound very interesting chords, but to get the voicings right was actually, that was one of the hardest parts. It wasn't the more complex stuff later, it was getting it simple, articulating the vocals with the backing of the orchestra, making sure the structure of the song is articulated properly. So it was quite challenging, but yeah, it was really, I was given like quite a lot of time to do it, which was, you know, it's rare to be able to get that deep in a song and really get to know what's going on in it. It was really great.
So you've had a couple experiences now working with Ed in the studio. Does this mean going forward you guys are more comfortable in that specific type of working together?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, as long as it's sort of playing to our strengths, like I did some string writing. There's a song called Save Myself on the album, which I did some strings on as well. Instead of a cello, I used a double bass, which I sort of prefer the sound to playing the bass line. And there's also strings on Happier as well, which we recorded at Abbey Road. So, I've done quite a few string arrangements.
you might get sick of that song, too. That's the next single here in the
Happier.
US. Yeah.
Yeah, but I haven't had to listen, like, because I didn't produce that, so I haven't had to listen to that over 1,000 times. So I'm cool with that song. Like, I don't mind.
And Ed playing you any new stuff?
But he's been spending the last month writing a album. I don't know if it's his next album or if it's something else, but yeah, he's been working very hard on that by himself in Suffolk, and because he's never been able to he has his own studio now. Before, he'd have to go to other people's studios. So I have, apparently they've done like 13 songs or something according to my dad, so I haven't heard any of those yet. So yeah. Will be interesting to see what sort of direction he takes it in. He wants to always surprise people, I think.
Yeah. Well, don't say no to anything. You have the power to.
I'm not going to tell him they're terrible.
keep an open mind, man.
Yeah, sure.
When did you first start doing stuff for professional? What were some of your first when you realized, you know, this is really my lane?
Going back quite a bit, I only really properly got passionate about classical music when I was 14, and I saw this documentary called The Art of the Violin, which is about the great violinists of history, and I play the violin myself, and my grandmother again bought this for me, and that really was what got me into classical music. And so I was writing loads of violin pieces, kind of virtuoso stuff, a bit like Paganini, just kind of messing around. And then this girl in my town who was a child prodigy violinist and basically just played the violin all day at homeschool type thing, she had a look at some of this stuff and suggested that I study composition. I'd never thought, it was sort of just saw it as a hobby, and that's kind of where it all started. So my background sort of concert classical, so it's a sort of university conservatoire sort of world rather than the film music world. So I, you know, I did that for a bit, but studied music at university, but I always wanted to go into commercial film music rather than academia, because I think if you're going to be a composer, like, doing it rather than teaching it is actual composition. Do you know what I mean? So and there's also, it's so fascinating because you have to learn how to write in so many different styles of music. The most bizarre requests, like, oh, we need some East African music for this, oh, we need some Brazilian you know, Bossa Nova for this, and then you have to go on Spotify and you listen to a lot of that stuff and kind of learn how to do that. And yeah, it's just endlessly sort of fascinating, really. You never know what you're going to do next.
So. I know I was listening on your SoundCloud page earlier, and I saw just there's, I mean, all the samples kind of take different places. There's one that was sort of like, I guess, time with D-Day, June 1944 was like one of the pieces. There's one that's very jazz and saxophone heavy. Do you have a favorite kind of style or a mood or feeling when you get a request for that you're like, oh, yeah, I can do this?
Well, when you're playing to your own strengths, i.e. sort of, you know, classical sort of leaning or, you know, orchestral or piano, that's just a lot easier for me to do. I mean, to write jazz, I can do it, but it's you know, you really have to work at it to make it actually sounding. And it's just, you, the music you write is what the director's taste in music is. It's not your taste in music generally. They're like, we want it to sound like this. And if they've got good taste, then you will write good music. And if they've got bad taste, you'll write kind of bad music, but like that's what they wanted, and you know the customer's always right. So it's kind of, some of them are good and some of them aren't, and you know, it's sort of, yeah.
When you watch movies now, do you get distracted because you're paying attention to the music, or can you follow, or does sometimes that part of you take over where you're thinking, oh, in this scene they should have done something here, or do you think that analytically?
Well, it's kind of handy sometimes, because you can watch a movie that's not very good, but the music's very good, and that will mean it was worth seeing.
Yeah.
So, and if the music's not good, that doesn't really spoil it. I mean, I think the best compliment you can have if you're a sort of film composer is that people are so immersed in everything that they didn't notice the music, and that means it's done its job of you fully immersed in the sort of experience.
Right.
I mean, I'm more into sort of sort of television show music rather than film. I'm very into sort of, you know, Netflix series and things, because you get to know the characters more, because there's longer time and you use sort of musical motifs to sort of to do that. And yeah, so that's sort of my main interest musically.
Is there just for some of the listeners to kind of get a sense of how your mind works in particular, is there a particular TV show or movie that you really enjoy the music and arrangements for?
I mean, quite a good example of how I would listen to music would be, I'm sure everyone's seen House of Cards and knows the music at the beginning with all the shots of Washington. And what the composer does in that is he has the bass line in A minor, and then he has the strings coming in A major, and I kind of feel it's a sort of, you got the Republicans and the Democrats, and it's sort of this big, great battle between major and minor. And this is a very unusual thing to do, to have A major and A minor at the same time. It goes against all the rules. There's actually, I think, Pop Problem, Ariana Grande, there's a bit where they have a major and a minor at the same time, and that was very striking to me. But yeah, so that would be an example of how, again, listening to pop music, that's how, sort of how I listen to it, in sort of more analytical kind of music theory terms rather than sort of lyric based.
Sometimes songs, they're a little bit different, stand out, and then that kind of starts a trend. You know, maybe Perfect sets a trend where we start seeing more of these kind of orchestral songs in pop hits.
I really wouldn't be surprised, yeah. Yeah, no, I think that will probably happen. It's great. It's great to bring the orchestra to a wider audience, because people don't think they like classical music, but they're exposed to it constantly in film music, and they just don't have ways to access the sort of stuff they'd like because they don't know enough about it. So the most popular pieces of classical music are ones that are featured in films, but there's a lot of other classical music which isn't in films, which would, if it was in a film, everyone would love. So you could got the second concerto of Rachmaninoff in I think it's Brief Encounter, but you could have put like the first concerto in it and people would have loved that just as much. So yeah.
Well, like, congratulations, Matt, on all the success of Perfect and the Sharon family having a nice little vacation here in New York. You guys doing anything special before you go back?
Well, yeah, there's this Elton John, I think it was the Grammy tribute concert, which Ed's singing in. I think he's doing Candle in the Wind, so that's in a few hours' time. So, yeah, looking forward to that. I went to the Stevie Wonder one, which was a couple of years ago, which was literally one of the best things I've ever seen musically. It was just incredible. So I have high High Expectations.
Was that what Ed and Beyonce sang?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible. And like the other guys that were in that, like everything about that concert was just incredible. And the songs are just incredible.
Stevie Wonder, musical genius.
Indeed, yeah.
All right. Well, wrap us up, Matt. We always close with a song. You're our guest. You pick a classic song for us to go with. Something maybe means something to you specifically.
Yeah, well, I think I'll play, we should play one of the songs that I was listening to when I was doing the arrangement for Perfect Symphony, which is When I Fall in Love, Nat King Cole, which is a orchestral background. So, yeah, I think people would like that.
Well, a very timely pick here at the beginning of Black History Month, celebrating one of the great black artists of all time. We'll let you introduce it.
When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole.
Matt, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, guys. It's been great.
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love. In a restless world like this.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.